Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
No, it's a pleasure. You're brilliant. You're a brilliant interviewer, man. Hey,
thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best with these things, just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for your lovely review. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
So enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it. And it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
This has been great. This has been a very different kind of interview. I like it.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews. So I'm really honored to be part of it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.
Today I welcome John Purcell to the podcast, Booktopia Director of Books and Australian author. The novel Girl on the Page is described as a smart, sexy, provocative and powerful novel of ambition, betrayal and redemption. The Girl on the Page follows the story of hard-drinking, bed-hopping, hot-shot young book editor Amy Winston on a downward spiral. Publisher Catherine Milne said, "The joy of this novel isn't just that it's a complete page-turner with lashings of sex, glamour, bad behaviour and wonderfully wicked insider publishing references, but that at its heart, The Girl on the Page is a deeply serious and intelligent novel about the power of literature, which asks searching questions about art and commerce, integrity and authenticity." My name's Danny V and I'm your host. Welcome, John. It's so lovely to chat with you about your novel, The Girl on the Page. I've actually been really excited to read this book for a long time now. There was something about it when I saw on social media that grabbed me about it straight away.
I'm so happy that you wanted to read it, and I'm so happy you have read it. It's great.
Now, for me, it was one of those novels I couldn't put down, initially because I think you've seen on social media how much I really loved the character Amy, but then because of the questions you raised about literature and aging and integrity and commercialism, why were these particular aspects of humanity important for you to explore?
They're the reason I exist. They're the reason I get up in the morning. So they're very important to me. The compass, I suppose, of where I live my life, the direction I live my life. Integrity is very important to me. You know, I was questioning whether I had, you know, in some of my life decisions, given over some of the integrity that I once had. I had my little secondhand bookshop. I was my grumpy man in the secondhand bookshop, my Bernard Black, and always trying to get people to read the classics instead of a commercial novel. And now I'm, you know, working for Booktopia, online bookseller and podcasting with some of the greatest commercial writers around. So it's I tried to work out whether there was some sort of compromise that I'd made.
Well, that's really interesting. And of course, now you work for Booktopia. So how did you change that mindset of sort of opening up that, I guess, for you, reading more books of different genres and newer books? How did that change for you?
I started off as a necessity. I had to do it because I'm a bookseller and I had to sort of do it. But then I got to know the writers. I got to know why they were doing things. And I started to respect their efforts and the way in which they planned these things and what they were attempting to do and their love of it and their enthusiasm. And it was so sincere, you know, and I kind of fell in love that way. So I was able to approach their books in a completely different manner, and something that I would never, ever have experienced if I'd stayed in my little grumpy little bookshop.
That sounds like a great bookshop, actually. Yeah, and that's what I really like about your podcast, the one you host at Booktopia, and that's what I've been trying to do here, is really just talk to authors about their work and about the process, because sometimes so much of those conversations are not asked and not started.
Yeah, I love getting behind the scenes. The great thing about the question, how does one write? Every author I ask, they give me a different answer. And every single author approaches this in a different way. And every single author got other things going on in their life that require them to maneuver around, to to schedule around to allow into their world. You know, it everyone has a different complications in their life.
Absolutely.
And this makes writers very adaptable, I'd say, very adaptable in their approach to how they write.
Yeah, and the writing process is fascinating because there's no right or wrong answer. Everyone, like you said, does it differently. And I guess that's what makes writing also difficult, because if you try and emulate writers that you aspire to or that you have liked before, that may not be the way that you write. So it's interesting, isn't it, how to find your own groove. How did you find your writing groove and your process?
I ended up copying a lot of the writers that I admire. So I would write little short stories in the style of, say, Dostoevsky, who I was gobbling down at the time, or I would rewrite out passages from Middlemarch. And so I spent a lot of time actually emulating others before I sort of fell into my own groove. And I don't know whether I could actually teach anyone to fall into their own groove. To me, it was all about my relationship with reading and examining. Once I'm fallen under a writer's spell, rereading the book and having a look at how they did it, why they chose certain things, and examining it that way. But whether or not doing that enough, at some point it switched on my writing style. I don't know. I don't know when it happened. It just seemed to happen.
Are you a planner, or do you just let your characters drive the story? How was your process in this particular novel?
This novel I had really basic plan. Like I did a couple of pages where I outlined quickly my three main characters, Helen, Malcolm, and Amy. And it was, yeah, in a sense, it was character driven. Their characters created the drama, and I followed where that went. I didn't really have a great idea where the ending was going to be. I let the book take me there, but I had a few bits what I needed to get to. So I had a few points that I wanted to reach, and so I aimed for that. I was very strict about it.
I loved the characters in your novel, all of them. Particularly, I just loved Amy because I just love these kind of complex characters. And I did hear on your podcast that you said she was kind of inspired by Amy Winehouse, which I thought, I wish I'd known that before I read it.
Yeah.
But I really loved her. I thought she was raw and powerful and damaged and destructive, but there was also these other layers to her where she was empathetic and clever. Tell us about the making of Amy, besides that kind of inspiration from Amy Winehouse and the pain of her music.
Well, I'm surrounded by strong women. My wife is a strong woman. My sisters and mother, very strong women. And I've always been attracted to them. And I work with so many brilliant women at Booktopia. And they're, you know, I look to these people in my life and help me bring out the strengths in Amy. The Amy Winehouse thing was there because that album Back to Black is just so heartbreaking in so many ways. And then the actual real story of her decline is heartbreaking. You think someone that talented, how could it possibly go wrong? That successful, how could it possibly go wrong? And so that question was in my head. You know, how could it possibly go so wrong? And how could you? Is there a way of turning that ship around? And so I tried to give Amy the ability, the natural intelligence to be able to turn it around. But you know, like with Amy Winehouse, you can't always turn your life around just because you will it.
Yeah, and she was such an interesting character. And I like one of the quotes about her that one of the characters say to her, "You say mean things just because you can." And I thought she was just such an interesting character because she carried so much depth and she just said whatever she wanted. She took all these risks. And it's actually I really like exploring those type of characters. And we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, you know, from the safety of your own home. So you can be in Amy's perspective and do all these wild things, but you don't actually have to do them, but you can still explore them safely.
Yeah, it's a safe place. It's virtual. I mean, novels are virtual reality, so you can, and the best novels that I've read allow me to go down paths that frighten me or test me in a practice run. And you know, you can sometimes do it with the great writers to a point where it becomes an experience for you. Your brain takes it as an experience and it helps you learn.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how I found this book too. And I also loved the other characters, you know, Helen and Malcolm, and the coming together of these characters. And what I thought was just so unusual but so incredible was these unlikely people, that they can come together and they can find something, you know, within themselves where they can sort of belong to one another. And I liked that. What was the challenge in bringing together these two worlds?
Well, the one thing that was constant for all of them was their love of writing and their love of books. So I've always thought of books as a secret language between readers, and it can easily fast-track friendships because of a common language, a common experience. And I use that to help that relationship blossom, because once Amy reads Helen's manuscripts, she's far more open to Helen and Malcolm's experience. But Helen is looking for a guide into the world that Amy lives in and is clutching onto her. So that's why that relationship fast tracks. But Helen is much more reserved, and it takes a lot of the novel for her to really open up to Amy.
Yeah, and I thought as well they shared a common thread of that kind of self-doubt or self-loathing almost, and then how it impacted them in each story. And I thought, even though humans are very different, we're all connected in these ways of self-doubt and self-loathing. And I think you captured that about humanity so well.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I fell absolutely and utterly in love with these characters. For me, they're living and breathing things. And Malcolm and Helen especially, I want to be them. I want to think like them. I want to, you know, it's just absurd, my obsession with these two. But Amy won me over as well. Her generosity that comes out, there's all these different things that come out in the novel as she goes through, that you can kind of, when you look it back, you can kind of see it's there. But it's that exposure to Helen and Malcolm that really brings it to the fore.
Yeah, I agree. And then seeing, you know, yourself and then exploring what you think, because your novel brought a lot of questions about things. And something you explore in the novel is a definition of literature. And as we said, you've been a bookseller, you're director of books at Booktopia, you podcast about books, and you're immersed in this world. Do you have a definition of what literature is?
If you found me in my bookshop before all that, I would probably have bored you with some long-winded explanation. I'm not as sure as I once was. You know, I think I'm more like Malcolm at the end when he pontificates about literature,
mm-hmm.
and it really is about quality first and nothing else. So if a book has a certain level of quality to it, then it's literature. Depending, it doesn't really matter what genre it is or what subject it's after. It could be a history book and it's literature because of the quality of the writing and the quality of the thinking in it. So I think I'm more like that, where I think literature can happen anywhere, and it really is a mark of its quality.
Yeah, I agree. I think also it's about the questions that it raises, and if it brings you to exploring different depths of your world and your life, you know, I think that's really important in books too.
Yeah, that's that wonderful subjective thing, because there are people out there who can read, can read a James Patterson book in 2 hours, and because they haven't read much else, it can change their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the themes in it might be the first time they've ever thought of them, you know. So, you know, that subjective aspect of it there is that roll of the dice that makes all my pontifications in the secondhand bookshop kind of ridiculous, because I didn't take in that chance aspect of it all.
And that's art, isn't it? And what I was thinking, what it made me think was that if someone as brilliant as Helen deliberately write something to appeal to the masses, isn't there some genius in that?
Yeah, there is. There is, absolutely. And this is the thing. This is what her agent would have said to her. You know, you've got, and this is what Amy's trying to convince her of in certain parts of the novel, that you know, what you've done, people don't do, and they it's very hard to do, and you seem to have crossed over and been able to do it. And you know, it's a sticking point for her because of her relationship with Malcolm and her relationship to her own art, that she feels that she won't recognise that there's a particular, peculiar kind of genius that she's managed to to write such a book.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, well, if you're aware of that, is there, does that give it more integrity? Like, I was trying to think about those kind of things.
There are so many questions in this book. I have no answers for them. That's why I wrote the book. I sort of spend most of my time asking these questions and getting these guys to answer my questions in front of me. And then they raise more questions.
They do. But that's, at least it's giving, you know, a lot to talk about, I guess, when you're traveling yeah. around promoting this book, because that's what I love about literature and art, that it raises these questions and then it makes us think about them in our own context, in our own lives. And that's why literature is important.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't see the world until I see it through literature. There's a whole, for me, that's how I sort of, I get the full picture. Otherwise it's all in black and white. I like my color view and I use literature to see in color.
I love that. I think I've done that too, but not articulated the way you did, but I think that's very good. I like that. Now, there's also conflict within Helen about aging, and Helen says youth had won out, and then, of course, she goes in to discuss an age of society. Now, this is an important issue, I think, in a world obsessed by youth. Is that where you were coming from in this?
Yeah, because I met, through my secondhand bookshop, I met so many wonderful, full individuals who used to come in my shop who were over 60, late 70s, who had wonderful lives, absolutely wonderful lives, and then had this enormous reading history to share with me. And they're not seen, we don't sit at their feet. You know, I sat at their feet whenever I could and asked them all these questions, and they would sit at the stool next to my desk in my shop and tell me these wonderful stories from their past. And I would always try to encourage them to write this stuff down, but they always felt that their family and their children didn't want to hear these stories. And they weren't interested in their books, and they were always worried about what would happen to their books when they died and things like this. And so I kind of wanted to celebrate these people in Helen and Malcolm. I wanted to draw attention to the wonders that are wandering around amongst us and celebrate a full, long-lived, intellectual, artistic life. And that's why I think that's probably why I made them so lovable.
And it's not often. Yeah, it's not often you read from the perspective of 70 and 80 year olds. And I thought that was really refreshing because they have such a rich past and rich history that is also really significant and important to the story.
Yeah, it's interesting when they start thinking about their own past and thinking about themselves as in youth and then in their midlife. And I've always been fascinated by this. I mean, I do love listening to people talk about long-lived lives and be able to try and recreate those kind of lives. I mean, I love history as well, so I spend a lot of time reading about the 20th century, and I love trying to bring that history into their memories within the book without overloading the book with continual lectures on 20th century history.
But the past is really important to the characters as well. I mean, it makes them who they are, and then when the past is lost to them, they have a difficult time moving forward.
Yeah, that scene where Malcolm sits on the end of the bed, it is, you know, when 50 years of living in one place is upended dramatically and quickly, and his ties to all these different people around him are all broken. I mean, I felt heartbroken writing that scene, absolutely heartbroken.
Yeah, I felt heartbroken for the fact that even when you go back to the physical space that was your past, like when you go back and you drive past your childhood home, you know, but you can never get it back. You know, you can try and reminisce about it. You can go and sit in the same space, but it's not going to be an 80s childhood again, or, you know, your favourite house you grew up in.
They changed the colour of the house. It's terrible. They chopped down the tree. And why would they do that? What barbarians? You know, there's all... That's always been something that I've always... you know, thought about, and just like you, it's frightening to think of that those things just don't come back. That's it. You know, you have that. You live the 80s once, you live the 90s once, and then it's gone. And that's it's done.
And they were great times, weren't they? Just such great times. I'm just starting a theme here. Every time I talk to someone, I start talking about the 80s childhood because I seem to be obsessed with the past, just like Malcolm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They were the times to grow up, I reckon.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of tragic confronting scenes. You definitely went there a few times. Did you surprise yourself writing some of the book in terms of some of the scenes you chose about, you know, maybe the violence or the sex without giving anything away?
Yeah, especially the violence, yes. I hadn't told myself that was happening. I wasn't very honest with myself as I moved towards that, as I could have been. And I thought long and hard about what was going to happen. It was kind of a self-deception, that part. But the sex side of things, to me, there've been discussions already, just in the, since the proofs have been going out and people talking about sex in the book. But to me, if you're not doing that in your own life, you're missing out. You know, Amy is where it's at. You know, you've got to be bad. You've got to enjoy yourself. And if Amy can guide people to the fun side of life, then great. You know, I want there to be more of that. People shouldn't be shocked by that. We should this is quite tame. You know, to think that this is considered as a, as anyway shocking is sad to me. I think people should be doing more of this stuff.
So Amy is everybody's role model in that way.
Yeah, I think so.
I thought it was really, really great hearing from a woman who was just so confident in that space. You know, she didn't care. And I thought that was great because, again, you don't read a lot from that perspective. I guess you do now. It's sort of emerging, but it's when you read it, it's good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, because there's so much repetition within storytelling about male life and male sexuality that we, you know, we hear the same story told again and again and again and again. When you hear it once from one book where a woman does the same sort of thing, it's shocking, and then again and again. So hopefully if more and more writers are writing about it in this way, and not all women behave this way, but some women do, and we need to have them in fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should be able to behave however they want to behave. And I think Amy was a great sort of speaker for that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm happy for Amy to be out there and to be as forthright as she is.
Now, my favourite line, be regular and orderly in your life so that you may be violent and original in your work. I just love that so much. And I think that rings true of so many artists.
Yeah, well, you kind of have to be. This is a, especially in this world we live in now, mortgages don't get paid by passion. and you kind of have to have some sort of steady job to keep the bills being paid. But you don't have to do that in your art. You can, pen and paper is all you need to be a writer. I mean, painting is a bit dearer, but not that much dearer. Drawing with pencil, it's fantastic. There are all these ways in which you can explore art without really breaking the bank. And in that, you can be bold and brave and passionate and loud and obnoxious as much as you like. It's fantastic. It's so cheap, wonderful.
And freeing, right? I felt like reading your book and living vicariously through your character. It was a very freeing experience as a reader.
That makes me feel very happy.
Now, Malcolm says about Helen, he says her writing sought change about how we ought to live, whereas Malcolm describes the world as he found it. Do you think this is true of most books, and which one does your book fit into?
I think mine's more like the Malcolm side of things. There are things there where I want things to be. You know, I want things ought to be like that. But I think if you were weighing it up, there are more of the is than the ought. I used to think that I was more attracted to the ought to be's, but I don't think so. I think I'm kind of pretty balanced now with being quite okay to read a book that is boldly about this is how it is, and it's a reminder that either we want to keep it that way and it's precious to us, or this should never happen again and we need to change.
And I was thinking about this question according to your book as well, and I thought, yeah, it does kind of sit in that Malcolm side about describing the world as you find it, but when you do that, you can't help but then place judgments on things like literature and age and integrity, and therefore you are kind of exploring the other side of it and the catalyst for change, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. So by shining a light on what was happening, it raises questions about, do we want it to continue or not? You know, and that's when you start doing the ought. What should we ought to do?
Yeah. So I thought maybe, you know, even though Malcolm describes it really well, I was thinking, I think most books, even if they sit in one camp or the other, they would definitely cross over because one asks the question of the other, I think.
Yeah. But, like, some of the oughts they're so beautiful. They wrap you into them and they completely, what do? They lull you into this false sense of security around their vision. And they're so well done that they feel like they're real. They really feel like they're real, and we love them for that. And we have a little bit of a holiday from reality for a bit. But they're not real. They're what things should be and not things as they are. And so they inspire us to make changes and want us to reach those kind of great heights. But they're not really describing reality. And as an artist, I tend to want to describe it as it is. But you know, I do have that idealistic streak in me, and I do like to pontificate and to say, but things should be this way and ought to be that way, you know. So the both bits will bubble up in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there's still a lot of sort of hope and positivity in the book as well. I mean, it is a real page turner. It is really character driven, but it's, you know, about your insight into publishing, and it's about all those issues we discussed before. But it's a real page turner as well, because you are desperately, like you said, in love and with these characters and drawn into them, that you want to know what their outcome is in the end. And that's what it was for me. I had to just keep turning those pages because I needed to find out.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge because you know, throughout my writing life, I've tried to write like Joyce. I've tried to write, you know, like these bizarre you know, moderns, and try to get to the real truth of the matter, but they're unreadable, what I tried to do. And there are certain experimental writers who, you know, I read through and had tears in my eyes from boredom, but wanted to see what it was that everyone was talking about. And in essence, I've sort of, in writing this, I've drifted. And I wanted to see if I could get as many people into the book, to make the front door of my book so wide that I could fit an audience, large audience, into it, to then bang them over the head with my pontifications about writing. You know, it was a big trap. And that sense of what happens next is definitely, you know, I was considered. I did it on purpose. I really wanted people to feel they couldn't put the book down. But I also wanted to make sure that as you went, that the characters developed, that the richness of their lives was revealed. And then the discussions got more complex and richer as you went into it. And by that stage, I'd got you. So you have to hang around to hear about my pontifications about literature and the like. That's the game.
Well, that's definitely how it worked on my end as a reader, so well done. Now, it's not your first book, but it's the first book under your name. Tell us about the publishing process. I love hearing about publishing process because it is just so different for everybody.
Yeah, so my first books were one of those strange quirks of publishing. I'd written a big mass of pages in 2003 and put them aside because no one would ever publish them. And then I went on to write this big historical novel, which I spent years on. And I didn't really think about publication. I just wanted to do the thing right. And so I just kept writing it and rewriting it. And then when I started working with Booktopia, I sort of drifted closer to the world of publishing. And I slowly worked out how that beast worked. And so I had relationships with certain authors who then told me about certain agents. And so I was kind of creeping slowly towards the publishing world. And so I gave my big historical novel to an agent who liked it, who signed me up, and then had no luck actually getting anyone to publish it. And so it was in the middle of this sort of this moment where I just couldn't get published that she asked me if I had anything else, and I said, I've got this filthy pile of pages that I wrote back in 2003. It's now about 2012, I think. And she said, I'll have a look. And she read a bit of it and said something like, this is too filthy to publish, Tom. This is ridiculous. I don't know if you can go to jail for this. What are you doing? And at that same time when she was rejecting that pile of papers, on the front page of the Herald, David Marr wrote this article about a book called 50 Shades of Grey that was suddenly going up the charts. And Random House had just signed a $1 million contract with the author and was just going nuts. And so my agent went from this is going to get me thrown in jail to I'm running with this to everyone I possibly can. And so it got published. It got published. Random House signed it up, and from the massive pile of papers, wonderful editor Beverly Cousins and I knocked it into the first novel. And so I think that was in March when March 2012, 50 Shades appeared on the front page of the newspaper. And by July 2012, a book was in the shops. So it was very fast turnaround. And that was my first experience of publishing. And it's stupid because that's not how publishing works.
I love that.
And so I had this completely wrong idea about how publishing works. I thought you give a book to a publisher, they sign it up, and then they work you like a dog, and then they publish you within a couple of months.
Well,
and
first then, of all, they tell you that your book's filthy and you're not getting it published.
Yeah. First they tell you that. They give you the hard facts. And then that's July, and then I think the second book came out in September.
Wow.
So it would, yeah, so we had to knock another one into shape because it was the same manuscript for the first two books. And then those two books were so successful that they came to me and said, we need a third. But there wasn't any third. We'd used all the manuscripts. So they said they'd like it for Christmas. And I was like, it's September. There's no chance of getting it for Christmas. And so I wrote it over Christmas on my annual leave in 4 or 5 weeks. And it was published the following April. So it was just, yeah, it was just crazy, absolutely crazy. And I thought that was publishing. I just went, oh, this is weird, but it's kind of hard work. But
And so that's not the process for this book, I'm assuming.
No, it's so much nicer. No, I started this book in January 2017. I wrote it on weekends. It was the only time I really had. And I finished it by June, July. And I handed it to my agent. She took it to Harper and a few other publishers, and Harper won the auction. And then they said, we'd like to put it out next October, so not the October of 2017, but October of 2018. And so I had a nice leisurely edit process and back and forth with publishers. It was very nice, very different from my first time around.
But now I've been looking at your Twitter feed since your book launch, and you're quite busy again.
I know, it's gone nuts. I went from this nice gradual pace to the publication date, and then, oh my goodness. Yeah, now I've been around town today.
So today was what, 8 bookshops, 2 interviews, ABC and this one, or more? Did I miss some?
Three interviews. There was one for Better Reading as well. So, okay. So it's quite a busy day.
Well, hopefully we've touched on some new things in this one, and by the time everyone listens to all of them, they'll have a really good idea of who you are as a writer and a human being.
This has been great. This has been a very different kind of interview. I like it.
Oh, good, good. Now, I know, as we've said, you're right in the midst of, getting this book out there, but what's next for you as a writer?
I'd love to keep on the book theme. I'd really like to explore a story around a bookshop. I really would. I mean, I've spent so many years in a bookshop. There's so many wonderful characters. Yeah, but yeah, there's also a temptation to see what happens to Amy later on. So I haven't actually confirmed anything yet. I do have another book I have to deliver to HarperCollins, so I will have to write one. But I haven't really come down to a decision of where I want to go. I have about, because I've been thinking about this for so long, I have about 4 or 5 books that I'd like to write that I've sort of sketched out. But because this is all new and this book is a different market, and I just like to see what happens. If it does well, then and people want another Amy story, then I will see what I can do on that side. But definitely, I'd love to continue on the book theme. I think there's so much more to explore there.
I have my hand way up in the air. Yes, another Amy novel, please. Now, quickly before we go, I don't get to talk to many podcasters. You're a fellow podcaster. What do you like about this medium?
I like that people can listen to it wherever and whenever they like. I think that's really the key to this thing, is that it's the flexibility of it all. It really is. I mean, people will be on trains, can be typing away at some data entry thing at work, can be mowing the lawn, can do anything and listen to a podcast. It's just wonderful. And I think when they get, like, podcasts, for we're serious, it's just unfettered radio. And so all these people are discovering new things about how to podcast, and it's like, I think that's radio.
Exactly. It's just got a cooler name. It's just unfettered. Yeah, it's got a cooler name than radio.
It's got a cooler name, and the tire's being cut. There's no regulation about being there at a particular time to listen to it. You can listen to it wherever you like, and that's the real big change. And so when people put together the things that that they're really saying, well, this is a new serial, or this is a new series, this is the way they're doing it, it's all been done before. It's just radio unfettered.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And what my favourite thing is, someone tweeted before, they were listening to my podcast when they were baking. So I feel like it's a baking podcast. You listen to people talk about books while you bake. I like that. They're taking pictures of their cupcakes.
Well, there's that cooking. People used to watch TV with cooking, listen to music, cooking. Why not plonk on a podcast and listen and
do it while you're cooking? And you create while you listen to other people creating. It's great. I love it.
Yeah, wonderful.
Thank you so much, John. Like I said, I thoroughly enjoyed The Girl on the Page. It's one of my favourite reads this year. It's an absolute page-turner, and I think it just conveys humanity as such, this beautiful mess with these beautiful characters. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you for writing it.
Thank you for saying such nice things about it. I'm blushing. I feel really, when people talk about it like that, it just makes you so happy. I can't believe it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.